Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, this is That Jazz Radio. We're on the air. We're waiting for Harold Scriber to call in first. And our interview today is with Harold Scriber. I grew up calling him Tank. And we're going to have David Shaw. So you're listening to Is That Jazz Radio? We're excited today because we have Jaleel Shaw, my homeboy from Philly. We're going to talk about music. But to begin our show, we're going to talk about... Harold Scriber and his activity with his music. Okay, we'll be right back right after this call. Okay, as usual, we had an interesting begin to our start of the show. Once again, we have Harold Tank Scriber. He'll be calling in, and then later on, we have our interview with Jaleel Shaw. We're really excited about that. Listen, you're listening to Is That Jazz Radio. We are the home of music and culture with nutritional value. Please visit our website. We have the Broke Vegan Cooking Show. We have a book club, and we also have Is That Jazz, the magazine, coming out in December. So we have a lot to offer, folks, when you come to our website. And again, our 24/7 live music stream is always up and running. So you're listening to Is That Jazz Radio, and we're going to listen to the music of Sheila Piper Moore, our last guest. And we're waiting for Harold Scriber to call in. Okay, we have Harold Scriber, and once again, this is ITJR. What's going on, brother?
Hey, how are you, Tracy? How's everything?
Hey, man, as usual, you saved the day. I was sitting here in the studio watching the Eagles try and figure out a new way to lose.
Oh, man. You know, the funny thing about those Eagles, statistic is they're 1-3 after a bye week under this particular coach.
Wow, I did not know that. You know, they have this gambling thing. I'm not into gambling, but they have this show. They said bet against the Eagles this morning, so I did not know that.
Right.
Yeah, I was listening to a show yesterday.
Right. I was listening to a show yesterday, and they were saying – that's why they bet against them, because they're 1-3 coming off a bye.
My goodness, man. Well, you know, growing up Eagles fans, we're used to any way you can lose, they'll figure out, you know. So it is what it is. Hey, man, it's been a minute, so how you been?
Oh, I've been very well. I've been doing good, you know what I mean, the best I can, like everybody else on this planet with COVID, you know. I'm essential personnel, so I've been continuing to work. But for artists and DJs and musicians, it's been a tough 7 months, man. Tough 8 months.
Yeah, man. I'm talking to a few artists myself, and they kind of mirror what you just said, bro. Like, you know, some that you know love to perform, that streaming somehow just doesn't make it, you know. And that live audience they need. So let's get right into it, bro. Like what's going on with your music? And I hear you started something else that involves the Hallmark Channel. So tell our audience about that.
Okay. Let me see. I guess when like you said, I was streaming actually 2 or 3 years ago just on Facebook, and then I had stopped when Facebook, you know, their terms of service, you really couldn't play music unless you were somebody. So I stopped doing that, but then when COVID hit, I started streaming again on Facebook. And then a company named Mixcloud, who also has a radio station, and they have a streaming service. You can play any music, any playlist, and it's legal because they play all the artists, the royalties, the producers, the royalties, and the writers. So I play there, stream there. Like I said, I do live, but after live is over, then the session is taped. And it's there for anybody to enjoy it. And also, I started streaming on Twitch in April. You know, it's owned by Jeff Bezos, Amazon. It's just another way for DJs to connect. So now I'm streaming with DJs from Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Florida, Miami, Philly, New York, all the big DJs in Europe, Australia. It's worldwide. All DJs I watch, and you can watch it 24/7. So that's what I'm doing now. And you know, my tag there is DJ MC Twizzle 678. So I'm on there 4 times a week. I was 6, took it down to 4 days a week, and about to take it to 3 days a week because of what you mentioned, dealing with the Hallmark and YouTube and channel. So that's where I'm at,
okay.
Man. It's a lot. I could talk forever. I could talk
well,
forever.
Well, we have about 4 minutes to Jay Lil
four
Shaw
minutes.
Calls in. And so, like,
okay.
You, like my thing is, like, I'm hoping that you give me the gateway to country music, man. Like,
well, that comes down. I hear you. It comes down to my schedule. I'm an event DJ. So I do all kind of events. You name it, I show up and do it, including bar mitzvahs, weddings, 60th birthday parties, 80th birthday parties, 4-year-old birthday parties. So I go across the gamut. So I have a feeling for country music. I also have a feeling for jazz. I grew up on rock and roll. And R&B is just soul and Motown, that's just everything. So on Sunday nights, 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, I play jazz, and the jazz music gets me such in a mood. About the last 30 minutes of the 2-hour set, I end up start playing some housey jazz music because the tempo just, you know, how can you not listen to David Brubeck Take 5 and then get excited? You know what I mean? So I'm listening to that and playing. And it just in the feeling, the music just hits you, and you just go on. So that's Sunday. Now Monday, I play country music just for an hour. I like country ballads. It's not all country music. It's like any other type of music. Country music has many different genres within it: the blues, up tempo, the pop country, the old school country. You know, sort of like Johnny Cash. Etc. And then I like the ballad country. A lot of instrumentation, singers have good voices, and they're telling a story, probably a love story. That's on Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. And then Tuesdays, I do straight classic rock and roll, because that's what I grew up on, rock and roll, listening to rock and roll, Led Zeppelin, The Who, The Knack, The Fleetwood Mac, just drawing a blank here, but it just goes on. Classic rock and roll from the 70s and 80s. David Lee Ross, U2, all those good bands. And then on Thursday,
see,
I slowed
down.
What our audience
know, man, we kind of grew up together in the same neighborhood, Parkside, Camden.
Right.
And I can honestly remember our wondering, like, what happened to Tank? He's listening to rock music.
Exactly. I don't know how I got there. It might have been from our neighbors down the street, Michael Lascalzo and John Lascalzo, the company. I just don't remember. But I just remember on a radio station was MMR and YSP here in Philadelphia area. And that's what I just started listening to, and that's where it stuck. So in my teenage years, everybody else was listening to R&B and, you know, soul and Motown. I'm listening to classic rock. Well, it wasn't classic rock at that time. It was just rock and roll. And it still followed me in there. And then the last day is Thursday, dinner hours, 5 to 6 Eastern Standard. I play slow jams, R&B. I call it the Blue Light Special. You know, things we used to play in that respect. Now, I'm sort of a strange DJ. I mean, when I'm streaming, because, you know, there's no audience, just me talking to the audience. But I like to play a little bit more in the song.
Okay, we're going to talk about that a little later, but guess who just called into our show, bro?
Did he call in? All right, nice.
Hello, Mr. Shaw. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You have no idea what this what an honor it is after we've researched you that you call into our station. And, you know, I'm born and raised in Philadelphia just like you. And, man, it's just such an honor. So we have our station manager, Harold Scriber, who we were having a conversation about his new music project and what he's doing. And just welcome to the broadcast, sir. And thank you for your time.
You.
Folks that don't know, Jalen Shaw is an acclaimed artist that grew up in Philadelphia. He's played with almost every major jazz musician out there. I looked at the album that he's been on, and I could create a playlist from the station just from the different albums that he's been on. But in the interest of time, Harold, what's your first question for Mr. Shaw?
How you doing, Mr. Shaw? How's everything?
All right, how about you?
Good. Doing very well. I actually have a question about Philadelphia because my dad grew up in Philadelphia. He was right around 59th and Baltimore Avenue, so I'm not sure exactly where you were. So my question would be, did you go to a Philadelphia high school? Did you graduate from a Philadelphia high school?
I did. I graduated from George Washington High School in Northeast Philadelphia.
Oh, very nice. I mean, doing our research, we're looking at it, I just couldn't find the answer, so I figured I would ask you.
Yeah, I went to a couple of high schools. I went to performing arts a little bit for a little while, too. But yeah, I graduated from George Washington.
Okay. Tracy, I got one more question to follow up to Philadelphia.
Okay.
All right, quick question. I was watching an interview not too long ago that you did, Mr. Shaw, and you were talking about community growing up. Actually, you were talking about the networking community, the jazz community in Philadelphia itself, and how strong it is, and how it helped to foster your talent and helped you grow. How was the community growing up in Philadelphia itself? And the reason why I ask that now, because I lived on the street I lived on now as an older man. I mean, I've been here 7 years. I know four of my neighbors, although there are like 20 or 30 of them. So I grew up in the city. I grew up in Camden where, you know, we seemed a lot closer and tighter. So did the community growing up, did that help you in Philadelphia?
You mean like the neighborhood that I grew up in?
The neighborhood, yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would necessarily say that. I definitely had some great friends in my neighborhood that I hung out with a lot. But, you know, I was in the house a lot, and my mom had me and different activities. So
activities.
I wasn't I didn't spend that much time in my neighborhood. You know, you know, I did a lot of different bands and ensembles and you know, theory classes. And, you know, even in sports, my mom had me in different things. But you know, I grew up in East Oak Lane, and it was a great, it was a very diverse neighborhood. It's something I really appreciated.
Right.
And I think that's something that helped me, you know, coming out of Philadelphia and meeting different people around the world.
Okay. Very nice.
Thanks, Harold.
Yeah.
Mr. Shaw, again, thank you for calling in. I want
to
begin with the influence of your mother because we kind of had a similar experience where my mom introduced me to a lot of music. So how important was your mother in just shaping your musical outlook?
My mother was very, 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 very important. She, I mean, if it wasn't for her, I definitely wouldn't be playing now or doing anything that I'm doing. She, you know, from the time I was probably 4 years old, you know, she had me in music, had me in and I shouldn't say just music. She had me doing all kinds of different activities, sports, you know, arts classes, you know, and she just whatever I said I wanted to try something, you know, she supported me. And, you know, whenever someone says, you know, for instance, when I was a kid, I was in, she had me in like a, kind of like a music class just for 4 or 5 year olds. And the music instructor of that class came out, one day and said, I think you should put him in more classes and keep him in music because I see something there. So she, from that point, she had me, you know, in violin and had me trying piano lessons, and you know, she always took me to hear music and see plays, the Nutcrackers, you know, anything that was happening in Philly, she had me there. And then by the time I was 8, you know, I was really into different arts, and a guy came to my school and said, you know, does anyone want to play instruments? And went home and talked to my mom about playing an instrument, and that's when the saxophone started. But even after, you know, after that, she took me to all my saxophone lessons. I went on and started playing drums. I took piano lessons again. And then she took me to all my ensembles. And every weekend after ensembles, we would go to Tower Records, and she would buy me any CD that I wanted to that I wanted to listen to. So, you know, just having that kind of support. And, you know, one thing that I talked about with someone, I forget who I was just talking to someone about this with my mom, is the fact that she didn't, it wasn't about the business. She didn't push me out there to try to make me famous or whatever. It was just to embrace and enjoy the music and learn the music and learn the culture. You know, she wasn't trying to make me one of those, you know, prodigy, you know, kids. She didn't want me to enjoy the music and learn about a culture. So it wasn't like an ego-based, you know, thing there. It was just about me learning about my culture and learning about myself and growing. So I think that for me, you know, and she still supports me to this day, you know. I mean, we're in a virus now, in the pandemic, but, you know, before the pandemic, she was still going to as many shows as she could, you know. You know, even I think the furthest she went was, I feel like, I want to say North Carolina. I played somewhere down south, and she drove down with Mr. Lovett Hines, who was one of the band instructors that I worked with. But my mom was just, you know, I could go on and on about my mom. She's an amazing human being, and she's, you know, the most important part of my life and the development as a human being, let alone musician.
Right.
You know, that's a great story. In researching about you, bro, one thing that was almost the same experience, I remember my mom gave me like a Fisher-Price closing play record player. Mm-hmm. And sitting in my room for hours just playing the same record over and over again, and kind of realized my love for music then. Kind of keeping in theme what you just said, it seems like you had a lot of access to music. And how important is that, especially as an educator, that maybe in children as young as 5 and 6, that we broaden their understanding of music by getting an instrument in their hand and in all types of genre? How important do you think that is?
I think it's extremely important. I think it's extremely important. You know, there have been studies about learning instruments and how it makes learning anything better or easier, you know. And I think it stimulates your brain in a way that no other art form or nothing else in the world can. And I think that's important for children, for everyone, you know. I think that being exposed to different music and different cultures is also very, very, very important. And, you know, people always talk about, you know, different genres being dead or stagnant, and it all comes down to marketing and exposure, you know. It's not about you know, the style of music or what the music sounds like. It's just about what a child or anyone is exposed to, you know. And I think it's really important for children to learn about, you know, especially, you know, I speak about the African American, you know, culture and what we've contributed to the world, not only in terms of music, but if we talk specifically about music, there's so much. It goes beyond what, you know, 90% of what you may hear on the radio, on popular radio today. There's so much that we've contributed. And I think that's important, specifically for African American children, to have an understanding of what we've done as a people. And if we go beyond that and we talk about different cultures and what they've contributed to music and to art, I think that that's very important too. And I think that what they probably get in schools is maybe 5% of the big picture when it comes to culture and art.
Well, Mr. Shaw, something I didn't share with you in just our communications, I'm also an educator in a middle school environment, and one time my classroom was across from the music classroom, and all of the students would hear was Adele and just popular music. So I went into the classroom and gave the instructor a Nancy Wilson CD, and she had no knowledge of who Nancy Wilson was. And it struck me that, you know, just the access to guys like you and music in general just broadens their horizon, and it also gives them a sense of worth. Like, I showed them a video of Esperanza Spalding, Black and Gold, and one of the other cultures said, "What's wrong with her hair?" And I was like, "Her hair is beautiful." And one of the children after the video said, "My hair is like that too, Mr. D. Is my hair beautiful?" So I think guys like you push our culture forward, and just trying to, you know, show how rich we are, not in music, but in literature and everything. I wanted to talk about, because I've talked to a number of artists, and I remember my father just making me listen to classical music. So what kind of foundation did classical music give you, sir?
Well, I started off, my first teacher was a classical saxophone teacher. So I started off playing with him for a couple of years. And, you know, I think that helped me moving into the jazz world. And, you know, I teach now, and from time to time I practice some classical etudes. But that being said, I still think that, and I'm very cautious with the use of the word classical music, because classical music does not necessarily, or should not be used to only explain, or it shouldn't be a term used just for Western, you know, European music. So
exactly.
I'm cautious with that, because I think that Charlie Parker is classical music. I think that, you know, Duke Ellington, Cannonball Adderley, and Ornette Coleman is classical music. And I think that that music technically, you know, has helped me too. I tell my students that everything helps, but, you know, I don't think that just going in one direction or just going in two directions. And it's interesting, because I teach at Manhattan School of Music, and I subbed for a class, African American history class, music history class, and we spoke about diversity in music, and how, you know, not just, you know, I know Manhattan School of Music is a jazz and classical school, and those are very two complex styles of music, you know, genres, but you can learn something from everything. You know, so as much as, you know, etudes have helped me, and I've learned a lot from etudes, you know, I grew up a lot on hip-hop music. You know, I listen to a lot of hip-hop music. I like African music. You know, I have a project coming up with a koto player, Japanese koto player, and I'm trying to learn that music. So I think that, you know, it's important to stay open If anything, I would say about, you know, learning different styles of music is you really have to stay open and try not to have a closed mind when listening or studying, because I think that that's when you limit yourself.
Yeah, and I was just recently exposed to klezmer music, and it's an artist in Colorado trying to blend that with jazz. And and she explained to me how that base of klezmer music and the tradition just allowed her to expand and bring jazz and hip hop and rock and roll and all to it. And you know, in studying, you said that was one of the things that struck me the most. One, your attention to our culture, which is for me speaking to the choir. And I just want to interject, there are some serious black classical musicians, too. So it's not an Eastern European thing, and especially if you understand Moors. So I'm glad that you clarified that. In terms of the African-American experience, how does that shape when you start to create music? How does that? You know, like, I know you want to get our voice out there. How important is that when you sit down and you create a composition?
It's very important. You know, I'm telling my story when I play or when I write, and you know, some of the stories may be more personal than just an African American experience. It might be just the Jaleel Shaw experience, but a lot of it is the Jaleel Shaw experience from the perspective of a black man. And there's been a lot that's happened throughout my lifetime that has influenced my music. So I think I think it's very important for the artist to reflect the times, and I think it's very important for the artist to share his experiences and his emotions through his art. So that's what I try to do as Jaleel Shaw. That's what I try to do as a black man. You know, that's what I try to do as a Philadelphian, as a human being. You know, I try to represent as much as I can. You know, I try to put in my music everything that I represent. Maybe I should say.
How important is Roy Haynes to you, sir?
Roy Haynes is extremely important. Roy Haynes is the father of the drums, and I don't even want to say in jazz, quote unquote jazz music. I feel as though drums, period. You know, he's one of the fathers of the drums. You know, when we have performances, all kinds of drummers come out to see him. You know, from rock, the guy from the Rolling Stones, Keith Richards. I think that's his name. He comes out.
Keith Richards.
Different pop drummers. You know, everyone loves him for his creativity, for his style, for his mastery of the instrument, and. I think one thing that I've learned about him is, you know, and looking back, I think I've learned this just by looking back over time and listening to the recordings that he's done with, you know, Lester Young to Charlie Parker to John Coltrane to Joe Henderson and Chick Corea, Pat Metheny. He's always sounded like him, you know. And
right.
I think his style and his music transcends time. You know, like he can. It never sounds dated. You know, and I think that's the one thing that I've tried to learn and work on is always trying to stay true to who I am, and in the moment. And I think that's why he's been able to do what he's been able to do, because he's always been in the moment. You know, he's never looking back about, you know, on what he's done. He's always trying to move forward.
Okay. I know one of the reasons why you agreed to our interview is because I communicated to you I'm from Philadelphia, and and just my, you know, the lineage of my father being Judge Durham there. But how important was growing up in Philadelphia in terms of the support? And before I say that, Homer Jackson wanted to say hi. He wanted to be a part of this conversation too, but he's on a project. And that's from the Philadelphia Jazz Project.
I said hello.
Yeah, and yeah. I remember – go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
I can remember reaching out to
Jeff Bradshaw, and in one communication, he was just like you, sir. He was like, tell me what time to be there. And so how important was just, you know, just growing up in Philly around such a rich culture, you know, the artists supporting each other the way you have me, sir.
It was very beautiful. It was amazing. Coming up in Philly, I got to meet a lot of great musicians and befriend and gain a lot of mentors like Shirley Scott and Mickey Moker, Bootsy Barnes, the great John Blake Jr., Byron Lancaster, Grover Washington Jr. These are people that I had access to, you know. These are people that if I went to see them perform, I couldn't go. I couldn't show up without my horn because they would always want me to sit in, you know. And they were all very encouraging, you know. I could call, you know, one person that I got extremely close to up until he passed was the great John Blake Jr. And I called him for advice on everything, on music business, on life. There was just a lot of love in Philly. And I think another thing was, it wasn't about, I didn't really even hear the term genre until I got out of Philly. You know, I was playing with different different groups. You know, I would go, you know, sometimes I used to play on the street with my friend Daoud, and, you know, Black Thought from the Roots would come up and line. You know, we would go to jam sessions with them. Bilal, a great singer, went to high school with them. We were all playing together, and we were just playing music. We weren't thinking about genre. You know, I used to do merengue gigs with Bobby Zankel, you know, when I was a teenager. So, you know, I think that was a beautiful thing. It was just like everybody knew each other and everybody played together, and nobody cared about status or what genre you played or anything like that. You know, we just wanted to make music, and we all supported each other and loved each other. So I think for me that was like just coming up under that, and there was never any pressure or never any ill vibes or ill intentions. It was just a lot of love and a lot of support, and I think for me that was extremely encouraging for me. And I think I left Philly with a lot of confidence and just positive energy, you know, going out into the world to play. And you know, I went to Berkeley from Philly, and I was just ready. I was just ready, you know, just from getting that push.
Yeah, your music kind of speaks to that. I have a question.
Thank you.
I was in the Blue Note one time, and an artist had just performed with Ron Carter, and we were all sitting at the table, and I mentioned Robert Glasper, and this one particular artist came out of, you know, like the strict, our father kind of jazz. If it's not Coltrane, it's not Miles, it's not worth listening to. And kind of threw shade on just the modern approach that Robert is doing, Terrence Martin. So how would you address folks kind of look at trying to expand jazz and still stay true, like you said earlier, trying to expand but stay true to the essence? How would you answer that question?
Well, you know, the thing about, you know, this music is that this music has always been growing. You know, it's always been, there's always been, you know, I've been fortunate to play with Robert. You know, Robert's on my first two records, and, you know, he's a friend, and I've always seen him doing, he's always wanted to do what he wanted to do, you know. And I think that the artists that are going to push the music forward are the artists that are not trying to stay true to anything but who they are, you know, and what they want to do, you know. So if you look at Charlie Parker, when Charlie Parker was playing, a lot of people didn't like what Charlie Parker was doing. A lot of people didn't like what John Coltrane did and started to do. I have bootlegs of John Coltrane playing with Miles Davis where people are booing him after his solo, you know, because he's doing something new. You know, people didn't like what Ornette Coleman was doing. So there's always going to be someone that doesn't like who you are or what you're doing. But, you know, the minute you let that stop you, the minute you're not being you, you know. So, you know, we need the Robert Glaspers and the Terrace Martins and the Christian Scotts and we need everyone. You know, we need everyone that's pushing the music, you know, there in the direction that they want to go in. You know, I don't see that much from my peer. I don't see that much I don't hear that kind of talk that often from my peer. We're all just trying to do what we want to do and encourage each other.
I first saw Robert Glasper at Marcus Garvey Park in Harlem, and what struck me is that this brother was exposing folks who had never heard jazz in his initial, you know, in the startup of his concert to straight ahead jazz, man. And we're a big fan. Like, you know, I kind of, in conceiving the station, in one of his albums, he has Anti-Pigeonhole. Most Def talks about music being pigeonholed. And, man, we have mad respect for his effort. And Christian Scott, too, man. It's, you know, we have to let new voices come in. That's what I believe.
Right. And, you know, and honestly, you know, I said my peer, but I don't hear a lot of musicians in general talking like that. You know, from all generations. Roy Haynes doesn't talk like that. You know, Roy Haynes embraces everything. He listens to everything too. You know,
I'm not going to speak. This artist is kind of well known. He came over to the table, and so I'm not going to put anyone on blast. But I kind of pushed back on him too. And what was really interesting, as you know, Mr. Glasper became, you know, even more relevant. He went on his social media and was happy to perform at the Blue Note with Robert Glasper. And I found that kind of interesting, man. And we always, you know, I kind of look, you know, just, you know, take a step back when someone refuses to let people grow, you know. So I just wanted your take, if you had ever had that experience. What was Berkeley like, and how did that, how did that influence you and help you become the master performer that you are today?
Thank you. Berkeley was great. You know, I had some really great teachers, people like Andy McGee and Billy Pierce, Shannon LeClaire, Hal Crook, Ed Tomasi, you know, that really, you know, took the time to show me things and encourage me. And, you know, just the school overall was just it was just a good time. You know, there were a lot of great musicians from all over the world that, you know, I got to meet and make friends with and still have a connection with today. And, you know, everyone was, you know, it was like a connection of Philly to me. Everyone was very encouraging. And I think when I got to Berkeley is probably when I got probably the most serious, you know, you know, you go from your hometown to an environment where everyone's coming from their hometown, and you see that what everyone else is doing, and all these other young musicians are just as serious, if not more serious than you. And, you know, you go in a practice room and start practicing, you know, for hours on end every day. So that environment was important for me because it just made me really disciplined and focused. And you know, I lived right across the street from a practice room, so I would wake up in the morning, you know, and go to the practice room before class, you know, go to the practice room after class, you know, go ahead and have dinner, come back to the practice room. You know, it was just a great, great, great environment to be in. It was cold up there, but I really had a good time in Boston. It was really, really a great 4 years of my life. I'm really, that's probably one of the most.
That's amazing.
I shouldn't say the most important 4 years of my life, the very important 4 years of my life.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's something else that our family, that our family truly aspirational and motivational to me, is that you started your own record label.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was the impetus in that, sir?
Well, I actually, I did my first album on a very small label. And when I did that album, I didn't get the best deal. I didn't really have my business chops together, I guess. And I learned a lot, you know, in that time. And I think one of the biggest things that I learned was that I could have done this on my own, and I could have promoted it the way I wanted to, and the money would be coming back to me instead of the money going into someone else's pocket. So, you know, I talked to different people. I talked to Robert Glasper, and I talked to who was signed to Blue Note at the time. That I started my label, and I talked to you know, musicians like Mike Marino and Marcus Strickland, who at the time were actually putting out their own records. And you know, one thing that Mike Marino said to me was, you know, what are you waiting for, and who are you waiting for? You know, and I'll never forget him saying that to me, because I was totally waiting for a label to pick me up, and I was totally ready to go. I was ready to go in the studio and ready to record my next album. And when he said that to me, he said, well, do you think you have the funds to do it? And I said, yeah. So he said, just do it. And that's just what I did. I went in the studio and recorded my second album. And I was able to promote it the way I wanted it, and market it and mix it and everything that I wanted to do. I was able to do it exactly the way I wanted to do it. So just having that feeling of control, I think, kind of gave me the kind of encouraged me to keep the ball rolling. It's definitely not an easy task, you know, putting out your own music. And but I think in the long run, you know, when you learn so much about the music business and you start seeing the checks come in, it's a great thing. And just owning your own, just owning your music is huge, you know. And I'm realizing that more and more, especially in these days with everything streaming and, you know, a lot of things are being used online. You know, people, if someone wants to use my music online, they have to call me and ask me to use the music, you know, and pay me. It's something that just happened recently, you know, and I didn't realize the importance, how important it was that I owned it, you know, because the check went right to me, you know. So, yeah, things like that are definitely important. I think, you know, at the same time, I think there are some great labels that can still help. You know, they can help get you out there, or they can help with your budget. But if you can do it yourself, I think that's a great thing, too.
Okay. In keeping with that theme, you know, in one of the interviews that you gave, and you talked about initially, money wasn't really your main focus. And so how important is it for artists to understand the business part and as they start to grow? I mean, from what I understood in your one answer, it was just the love of art and culture, music, and your people that really was your motivation. And you know, where some are just going for the money and they don't take time to hone their craft or really, you know, have their skills, learn their skills, and learn the music, and they turn out to be one-hit wonders. How important was for you to understand that? Like, in other words, you need to understand the business, too, if you want to get into this music.
Right. Well, honestly, I think that was just how I was programmed, you know. I just loved it. I have been playing for such a long time that I never, and it's funny because, you know, over time, like I remember Nicholas Payton came to Berkeley, and I guess I hadn't really thought about it, and I guess maybe I did think that things would be pretty easy, you know, just because I had been doing it so long, and I've been, you know, I was practicing hard, and I remember Nicholas Payton coming to my school and giving a workshop and saying, you know, if you really love this, you got to know that you might not make a lot of money doing this, you know? And when he said it to me, it kind of stunned me because I hadn't really been thinking along those lines. I hadn't been thinking, I'm about to graduate and how am I going to, you know, make money? And I remember, I mean, I actually went to Manhattan School of Music for grad school after that, but I remember moving from Boston to New York and being scared, you know, like, what, you know, what am I going to do? And fortunately, like, not too long after I moved to New York, I, you know, I started playing with, like, Dominguez Big Band and the Vanguard Big Band and the Village Vanguard Big Band and the Count Basie Orchestra. And, you know, it was a blessing to me because I literally did not know how I was going to make money when I moved to New York. And so I think that, you know, there are, like, and even now I tell my students to learn about the business. Because I've definitely gotten the short end of a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of deals, but some deals, because I didn't understand the business like I should have. So it is important to have a business sense when it comes to music or any profession. But at the end of the day, you do really have to love it, and you have to persevere. You know, you're going to have days when you might not feel like playing, or you're going to have days when you might not be working a lot. You know, like, we have this pandemic and things are slowed down. So I think ultimately and overall, you just push through, and I think that has made my love of music strong, you know, or just love what I do strong. Just being able to push through, you know, I'd be lying if I had sat here and told you that I never had my moments where I wanted to quit. Or I never had my moments where things were not really happening and things were slow. I was discouraged. But I think overall, if I walked away from it, I don't know what I would, you know, I don't know what I would do because I love it that much. So I think that's what it is. You know, it's I mean, that's what love is. You can't walk away from it. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you really love something and you really care for something, you know, you're going to push through, and you're going to work it out, you know. So I think that's, for me, with just the long, just being in it, you know, longevity, being playing and learning. And I think also the fact that I want to continue learning, you know, I realize that I have so much more to learn. You know, there's so much more that I want to do that keeps me, playing, you know. And again, I might not do it every day. I might not do it every week. But when I get to it, you know, I try to really get to it, you know. When I get on the stage, I try to play like I'm not going to get to play again, you know.
Mm.
So I think that's the thing about music that's important, is just being able to express yourself and, you know, and be creative is just a blessing, you know. So I'm thankful for that.
Mr. Shaw, we just have a few more questions, and I thank you for your time. Harold, do you have any questions before we let this gentleman go?
Yes, I do. I sort of have a technical question. I saw you in an interview, and you were talking about your mouthpiece. And you were saying the brighter and the darker. Now, is that actually in the sound that you hear in your ear, or is that the emotion that you feel, that you add
it? No,
that's
the sound that comes out of the saxophone. That's the sound that comes out of the saxophone.
Okay.
A mouthpiece or a saxophone can change the timbre of your sound, the texture of your sound. So, yeah, that's what I meant. You know, so a sound can get brighter if you have a different kind of mouthpiece, or it can get darker.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. I was thinking about it, but you taught me. I was listening to an interview you did, and you taught me something as an artist. I'm a DJ. I'm an event DJ. I'm in no big club. But one thing you mentioned that you tell your students, or you should have all artists do, is transcribe their music.
Uh-huh.
So my question to you is, say you did a solo and you actually, do you know what you're going to play, or are you just feeling it? Now, will you go back and transcribe that piece of music that you just played, just at a thought of your head, or is it just music in, that you hear in general that you say and transcribe and listen to? And listen to yourself.
Wait.
Is what you said.
Oh, yeah, when I say listen to myself, no, I don't go back and transcribe. You know what? Sometimes I do listen to myself, and if I hear something that I like, maybe
okay.
I might try to figure out what that idea was.
Okay.
I try to be as spontaneous as I can, you know, when
I
improvise, but, you know, I do
okay.
go back and listen to myself when I transcribe. But when I'm talking about transcribing, I'm talking about transcribing other artists, you know.
Okay.
You know, getting information
okay.
from, you know, other recordings.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, as a DJ, I always remind myself, go back and listen to what it sounded like. To you, to me, it sounded perfect. But then I go back and listen, and I said, oh, that was so bad. How did I do that? But that helped me out to remind me to go back and listen and learn from other people. So I appreciate you.
Yeah.
Your
yeah,
music
great.
Is awesome. And listening to you.
Thank you.
Something else.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Just two more questions, sir. And the first
okay.
one is, this pandemic, how has it affected you in terms of artists, you know, your inspiration, the process of going through music, and not being able to get in front of a live audience and have that exchange? I understand streaming is, you know, one way we try to connect with folks, streaming live concerts, but not having that audience energy coming back to you on stage, feeding your performance. How has that, you know, how has that affected you now that it's been almost 9 months?
Yeah, it's been heavy. You know, I didn't expect it to be this long, and as time, you know, started to really draw out, and I realized what it was going to be. You know, I had to really, and I'm still processing it. You know, I had to process it and figure out what to do. I think for me, that connection that you make with the people, it can't be duplicated. It can't be substituted. You know, there's
mm-hmm.
there's no feeling like that. And I think that's what I realize more and more. It's like, man, part of what I did had a lot to do with the connection that I made with people when I was playing. You know, that feeling, you know, was a big reason why I did what I did. So it's been hard, you know, and it's something that I think about, you know, every day, and something that I deal with every day. You know, I've had days where picking up my horn, you know, may be difficult to do. But you know, I'm being positive, and I'm trying to be as optimistic as I can, because I do think that we're going to get through this. I think the streaming does help. You know, earlier on, I was getting online from time to time and just playing solo for people on Instagram or you know, whatever streaming website I could, and that helped just to make that connection with people. But it's there's nothing like, you know, and it's not just playing for people, it's traveling and going places and meeting people and trying new food and, you know, all of that I missed, you know, that I've missed over all this time. And I know a lot of artists are definitely going through it, and we're trying to figure out, you know, things, ways to move forward in this new situation, because we don't know when we're going to get back to it, even if there is a vaccine. You know, we don't know when they're going to start opening up clubs and letting people in and having us play the way that we were. So it's a challenge for all of us. You know, I've been doing master classes online that people, you know, get on Zoom and interact with me. I've been teaching at Manhattan School of Music, which is basically all online. So having that connection has been good. But overall, it's definitely something that, you know, I'm still processing, and I'm still trying to figure out, and I'm watching other musicians and seeing what they're doing, and hoping that you know, this will be over sooner or later,
right?
You know, and I can get back to it.
Yes, agreed.
And we come out on the other side stronger. Mr. Shaw.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, normally I have this thing where I interview folks. I ask them one word and ask them their immediate response. But in just listening to you, this interview has been quite cathartic for me, especially when you say there are times when you may not feel motivated, but you still do it, you know? So I'm actually going to ask you two questions. And one, in considering the times that we face as African-Americans in this country, how we're being defined and how we're being misdefined, how our culture is being appropriated and all like that. So if you don't mind, sir, I'm going to ask you two questions. And the first one being unity. What's the first thing that comes to your mind when I say unity?
The first thing that comes to my mind when you say unity is support, you know, love and support.
That's right.
Okay. And the next one I'm going to ask you to expand on your answer a little bit, if you don't mind, sir. And that's humility. Being humble.
Being humble, humility, I think, is to really be at peace and to really be reflective, self-reflective, you know. You know, just like I said earlier, and I talked about listening to myself, you know, listening to, you know, I mean, I could easily go and listen to what other people are doing and say, I don't like this, I don't like that, I don't like this. But, you know, or I can say that about people. I can say, I don't like this, I don't like this, I don't like this. Something that I've been trying to do as a person and as a musician is you know, even the things I'm not crazy about, getting the information and learning what I do like about it, you know, trying to learn something from that person, be it that person's personality or be it that person's musical style or concept. And, you know, just I've been just trying to grow with, you know, with people, be at peace with the world and most importantly, be at peace with myself, you know, listen to myself, you know what I need to work on. You know, and that's in my music and in my personal life, always thinking about what I need to work on, you know, how I can change, how I can get better. And, you know, I think that's something that, you know, when it comes to humility, it's important. You know, when you're self-reflective and when you're thinking about how you can be a better person, you're going to find something if you look. And if you really want to work on it, then you're going to have to humble yourself. You know, you're going to have to humble yourself, which means sometimes asking questions. I ask a lot of questions. I ask questions, and I feel like I'm always searching for something. I always want to know, like, you know, if I want to know about something, I'll watch a million videos about it, you know, on YouTube, or I'll look it up to see as much information as I can about something, you know. And I think it's just important for us to be that way, you know, and have empathy. You know, I think empathy is a big part of humility. You know, understand where someone is coming from and understand that someone may have dealt with something that you don't even, you've never experienced, you know,
right.
But understand that person is going through something or may need support or may not be able to support you in a way that you may need them to because of what they've been through, you know. I know that's a long answer, but that's what I think about with humility. You know, I think about, you know, self-reflection and empathy.
That was awesome.
I was hoping for the long answer, to be honest with you, Mr. Shaw.
It was awesome.
You know, you're from East Oak Lane. My family is from the bottom, so you guys are always a little bit smarter and dressed a little bit smoother than us dudes at 39th Fairmont.
Okay.
Okay, so, you know, that humbleness came across in just listening to you speak. I'm like, okay, why couldn't Dad move us out there? But what new projects are going to come out of this, and what can you tell our audience to look forward to you coming from you in the future?
I'm hoping to record a couple projects, a few projects. One of them is going to be with a koto player who actually lives in Japan, so I don't even know how that's going to happen or when. Another one is hopefully with my quartet. I hope to record sometime in March or April next year. So hopefully that'll be out sometime next year or maybe year after, depending on the time it takes to get it done. And I have one more that I'm going to keep it a secret right now until it really happens. But I'm hoping to get some stuff out by at least the middle of next year, at least spring, fall 2021.
Okay. I'm sure our listeners will look forward to it. And, man, I had a chance in researching you to see that performance at Smalls in New York. Whoa, bro. Oh. Like, whew.
Thank you.
Man, did you put it down that night, man? Like, wow. You know?
Thank you, man. Thank you.
I'm a little nervous now because if I stream it, you'll be like, okay, he didn't tell me he could stream it, you know? So.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You know, that was amazing, sir. Your talent is transcendent. Yeah, like it's really something. So, Harold, I thank you for your input. Harold, you have any other questions before we let this gentleman go?
The one we were just talking about, was that the piano player was Sullivan Fortner? Was that one?
Yeah,
that
Sullivan Fortner. Yeah.
Oh, my. I about lost my mind watching that. Oh, my
Tank
God.
Was
so good. I kid you not. I was like, oh, my soul was floating. I was like, this is all right here. Man, I applaud you, brother. Bravo. I was like, and that's what I when I stream music, I tell people, listen, I only play music that touches my soul. If it don't touch my soul, I'm not playing. That right there, I was like, man, this took me out. I wish I was sitting there live. I wish I was.
That was truly amazing.
I appreciate you, man, and your knowledge. I appreciate your knowledge and your humbleness and just showing people the way to do it. That's all.
Thank you.
Just find the drive, find what you like to do, and just do it. So I appreciate you. Thank you for the interview, and
thank
I hope
you.
To meet you one day in person.
Definitely. Likewise. Thank you for having me,
Mr. Shaw. Thank you as always for looking out for another young man growing up in Philly. You guys show love that's unreal, and it's much appreciated. Like for real though, man. So. Thank you, sir, and you have a blessed day.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
Thank you. Awesome. Pleasure. All right.
Thank you.
All right. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.